Good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And tonight we will sound a little bit different. Although Cliff and I are in the studio, we only have one phone volunteer with us. So if your call doesn't get answered right away, please be patient. Wally Derleth is on the phones back there alone because we're still practicing social distancing around here, not trying to bring in a lot of volunteers, just to keep everybody safe. We do invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends in the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997. And he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife Julie and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks again for coming in.
Hey, Bill, thanks for having me.
All right. Once again, we ask you to call in with your questions tonight, but, take it easy on Wally back there. He gets a workout during these shows. The number to call is 800-552-8502. 800-552-8502. Got a call coming in already, so somebody's waiting on the dial. Now, Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip, and would you like to refresh our memories so that we can begin this week's program proper?
Yes, we talked about putting a cam up on your property. If you're curious about what kind of critters live on your property, either an urban backyard or even a rural property, these are great ways to see what's coming to a feeder or a water source. You don't want to just point it into the abyss of the woods or the pasture. You want to try to focus it on something that might attract critters. So food source, water source, or maybe if you want to see what kind of mammals are running around, you can look for a little wildlife trail and point it at that. They're also valuable if you have some mishaps, like if you have a vegetable garden and something's eating your tomatoes and you don't know, you think maybe it's the neighbor grabbing them, you might check it out with your game camera and see that it might be your favorite dog that's coming over there and eating your tomatoes. So they're really useful for a variety of projects. I talked to a Parks and Wildlife colleague, Sean Willis, about game cameras. He knows a lot about them. And I said, well, what do you look for when you're shopping for one? Because there are a lot of good ones for under $150, even some that are under $100. He said the key thing for him is the battery, what type of battery you put in it, because they, depending on how often you want it to go off, it can eat up a lot of batteries. And he prefers those cameras that use the AA battery. And I agree, that's what I use. The C and D batteries are a little clunky, sometimes hard to find. AAs are everywhere available. And always recycle your batteries as well. So, yeah, if you're just curious what's out there, and we're not talking about trespassers or burglars, we're talking about the critters that live alongside you, set out a game camera, also known as a trail cam, and see what you get, and keep a list. It's a really fun way to document what you've got on your property.
Now, how about rechargeable batteries? Would that be something you would recommend? They're a little more expensive, but I have a set of four at home and they come in handy.
Yeah, and that's they make a lot of those in AA, so that would be a great idea. Yep.
Yeah, it's a great way to cut down the long-term expense, but the short-term is a little bit of an outlay of money.
Right.
So, plus, you got to get the rechargers. So.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you have a photo you would like Cliff to identify, we may not get to it during this show, but we will get to it to the next show. And you email me at wbeckett, that's wbeckett, at lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu. And, well, we're going to go to our profile species next, but we do have a call online. So, Elizabeth, please hang on. Cliff's got a profile species to go through. And what do you have for us this month?
Okay, this evening we're profiling the yellow-billed cuckoo, and we have two different calls to play for you. So let's listen to the so-called coo call. Okay, so now let's listen to the same species. Again, the yellow-billed cuckoo give the more often heard calp call here. So the calp call is spelled K-O-W-L-P. It's simply reflective of the sound it's making, or a way to verbalize that specific sound. This cuckoo of woodlands and forests is about the size of a mourning dove, with a lean body and a long tail. They're mostly brown above, white below, and during flight show hints of rust color in the wings and white spots in the outer tips of the tail. The bill is stout, slightly curved, and the lower portion is noticeably yellow. With binoculars, you'll also notice a thin yellow ring around the dark eye that's known as an orbital ring. This bird has the ever-popular colloquial name of rain crow, which my father and grandfather grew up with in East Texas. This species is one of the few that will continue to vocalize during a drizzle or a light rain shower, hence the name rain crow. But there's certainly a myth that hearing this bird call during cloudy weather means that you better grab an umbrella because it's going to rain. The bird is no predictor of the weather. If you find a yellow-billed cuckoo perched in a tree, they're often easy to study as they can sit motionless for long periods, slowly rotating their head up and down, keenly watching for prey moving about in the canopy. They eat a variety of large insects in the canopy, including caterpillars, cicadas, grasshoppers, and crickets that they glean off of limbs and leaves. They're especially fond of smooth, spiny, or hairy caterpillars, including tent caterpillars, during periodic outbreaks. Cuckoos and many other birds help keep numbers of insects in check, which benefits many trees covered in hungry insects. Remember, these insectivorous birds are great neighbors to have, especially anyone owning trees on their property. Some cuckoos lay their eggs in other birds' nests. Over 50 species of Old World cuckoos and 3 species of New World tropical cuckoos are what we call obligate brood parasites, which means that they reproduce only by laying their eggs in the nest of another species, a host species that ends up fostering young cuckoos. The yellow-billed cuckoo, however, is what we call a facultative brood parasite, which means it occasionally drops its eggs in a host nest, while the rest of the time it's fully capable of building its own nest and raising its young. This species in western states like California and Colorado have declined dramatically, which is a strong indicator that our riparian systems are unhealthy. What I mean by this is that western creeks and rivers that were once lined for miles with native trees like cottonwoods and willows have been severely altered, and the number of those trees which serve as homes for the yellow-billed cuckoo have been reduced in both quantity and quality. To see a photo of a yellow-billed cuckoo snapped by our favorite photographer James Childress, please go to the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I don't know about predicting rain, but I prefer the horned toad for predicting rain. But that's a different show, so we'll get on to that next time. And we do have a first call on the line right now. Elizabeth from Jefferson, Texas is online. Elizabeth, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
It's not really a question. Well, I guess it is in a way, but I'm just kind of a backyard bird watcher. I just know the native birds. But there is a mockingbird that I saw last year, and it is not the traditional colors. It is very, very light, almost white gray. How unusual is that?
Well, that, you know, in strong light, and meaning bright sunlight at noon, that they can look really pale. That sun really bleaches out color. So I would think you possibly saw that, and that's true.
I know my birds.
Okay,
East Texas birds. This is what I would call an albino mocking.
Okay, well that's certainly possible. We've had several callers in the past talk about albino mockingbirds or partially albino mockingbirds. They're not unheard of, so it certainly could be what you saw. Is he still around, or is this a thing from the past?
Yeah.
Okay.
It lives in this one particular area, and I see it at least two or three times a day.
Okay. And so what the word to look up when we hang up, Elizabeth, is the word leucistic. And let me spell that for you because it's the better word than albino. It's leucistic, and it's spelled L-E-U-C-I-S-T-I-C, leucistic. L-E-U-C-I-S-T-I-C. So anyone interested in that word can Google that and see what it means. But it's basically the dilution of color. And virtually the absence of color. So that's probably what you saw as a leucistic mockingbird.
Yeah, it looks so out of place, but it looks so beautiful too.
Yeah,
but it does not. It's not the medium gray as a mockingbird.
Okay.
With a darker gray streak, you know, markings on a regular mockingbird. This is totally, I guess we were gonna call it leucistic.
Yeah, and maybe we can figure it's a female. You could call it Lucy the Leucistic Mockingbird. How about that?
Oh, that sounds great.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
I always say name them. That's always good. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And although he didn't want to go online, Matt from Shreveport did call in to say trail cams are great and can be used in most situations and also provide great pictures very often. So if they get that perfect shot.
Yeah.
It's a great way to capture some interesting wildlife out there. And if you're into it, then I definitely suggest you do that.
Yeah.
We go next to Julian from Austin, Texas. Julian, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hi, my roommate and I noticed some yellow-crowned night herons nesting in a tree in our neighborhood, and they are directly over the road, some of them. And we read that they usually nest, like, directly over rivers, and we're probably, like, a mile away from the nearest creek, and pretty far from the nearest like actual river.
Mm-hmm.
And other friends of ours have noticed them nesting directly over streets, like nowhere near water. And I was just wondering, is that abnormal or
no? They're increasingly nesting in yards on property away from water. That doesn't seem to be critical. I don't know if maybe the roadway symbolizes them to them some kind of opening underneath them, but that they should know the difference between hard pavement and water. So I would think it's just maybe the structure of the tree and how they selected that perfect fork to put the nest in. But yellow-crowned night herons are, you know, the adults are going to fly however far away, even if the creek is right below them, that doesn't mean that all the food they need is right below the nest. The adults would still have to go up and down the creek or bayou or lake shore and cover a lot of ground to get all the frogs and crawfish and other things on the water's edge that yellow-crowned night herons eat. So you'll see them feeding in ditches along roadways as well, but typically they're going to be after, they're going to get their feet wet typically, yellow-crowned night herons when they're feeding. So, yeah, and there's, of course, Julian, if the next question is what to do, you have to let nature take its course. There's nothing you can do. There's no agency that's going to move your birds.
Sure.
There's no rescue needed. This is not a, you know, there's the worst is going to be when the young fledge, but they're probably not going to just hop out of the nest. They're going to do what's called branching. We use that term more for raptors, but I've seen herons do that as well. I've seen baby green herons especially, which are really cute. They'll run out of the nest when they're big enough, but they're not ready to fledge, and they'll run up and down limbs, and they'll get to an edge and practice flapping their wings. Raptors are really good at this. So what I'm saying is I'm hopeful that your yellow-crowned night heron nestlings, when they're about ready to fledge, that they'll do this branching exercise and go to far away from the road so they don't land in the street.
That's good. But
even if they do, that they should, if they have a moment to run, they should be able to get out of harm's way of the car. But then if it's an urban setting, there's so many other harms, pets, curious people, curious kids, but pets are probably way worse on some of these things, because, you know, cars are confined to roadways, but pets roam everywhere. So anyway, so if this is a possibility, maybe talk to your neighbors about what's going on. I think the neat thing is to watch the night herons, and then what a lot of people like to do is look under the nest to see what kind of bones and carcasses are discarded, and you can see like an exoskeleton of a crayfish and say, oh, look, he likes crawdads just like any Cajun does, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
and they'll eat frogs and all kinds of things, but you probably don't want the nest over your patio, because all of a sudden where you like to have your evening iced tea or your cold adult beverage, you've got all these nasty smelling crawfish tails and so forth. So so the road is probably a little bit better. But anyway, I would think it's pretty neat, Julian, to watch this play out and enjoy the moment. And I think, are you an example of someone who's been locked up to COVID and have found birds to look at, or have you already been a bird watcher?
Absolutely. Cool. It was something I was interested in, but this definitely quarantine has helped me with the time to dive in and get some books.
Cool.
Well,
you've got a neat one in your yard. Not everybody can say they've got near their yard a yellow-crowned night heron nesting. So that's pretty cool.
Very cool.
So, yeah, very cool, Julian. So enjoy your night herons. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
You bet. And I have a novice question. How many types of herons are there?
Well, there's lots. There's two different night herons. He called about the yellow crown. There's also a black crown night heron, and they're sympatric across a lot of their range. Sympatric means they occur together. But in Austin, there are no black crown night herons nesting in that area. So he's got yellow crowns. But black crowns could be there in the fall and the winter. So pretty neat. But other herons and egrets, there are probably, I don't know, 20, maybe 20 species if you include all the allies.
The great blue heron and all that.
And the allies being ibis and bitterns and wood stork and so forth.
I have to get my camera out, because I've only caught the great blue heron and some egrets too.
Right.
I've caught on film.
And most of them are wetland inhabiting. The biggest exception is the cattle egret, which we've talked about many times. That's the big white bird that you see walking around cattle pastures, around livestock. Mm-hmm. And people think that they're there to pluck off ticks and other ectoparasites. And I've mentioned this before, that would be like us trying to survive on the bottom scraps of a Cheetos bag. Not the Cheetos that are large, finger size. I'm talking about the little shards. You'd have to eat a lot of shards to get enough to get you through the day. So instead, the cattle egret is capitalizing on this big, giant bovine walking along and scaring things up with its hooves, with its shadow. And when you're a grasshopper or a mouse, You're scared of that, so you give up your location and you flee, and the cattle egret pounces on it.
Something a little meatier for dinner.
Yes, so. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have lines open right now, only one call online or on hold right now, and that's Shelley from Smithland, Texas. And we're going to you right now. Shelley, what's your question tonight for Cliff?
Hi, Cliff. I have two questions. And my first question is, what are your favorite places to go bird watching? Or I find myself really getting into the sounds of birds.
Oh, cool.
And I just moved back to Smithland, and I just forgot how that's bird diversity here. Yeah. I'm from Austin.
Smithland. Tell me where that is. You're not saying Smithville, are you?
No, Smithland.
Where's that?
It's about 15 minutes outside of Jefferson.
Okay. What county? What county is that?
Marion
County. Okay. I don't know Smithland.
That's okay. Up here in our neck of the woods.
Yeah. So you're not
it's
far from
Caddo Lake.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Okay, and then you had a second question. Do you want to wait on that one, or you want to throw that one out first before I answer the...
I can throw it out first because it kind of relates to that. So I've discovered some really cool state parks around here, and the other day I ended up in Dangerfield State Park, and I heard some birds, that I've never heard before, just the beauty of that. And I ended up recording some of that on my phone, and I was just curious as to what that might be. So I don't know if you could identify that by sound.
Well, Bill, do we have enough time? If she's can you
sure
can
if you can find it,
can
go
you
ahead.
Pull those up, or just pull up one or two. We can't go
play
through
them.
All 25 of them if that's
oh,
what
no,
you
no,
have.
No, I've just got it. It's a little 20-second recording.
Yeah,
and then email that to us too, so that we can put that on our webpage.
Go ahead and see if you can fire that up, Shelley, and let's listen.
Okay, sure.
And in the meantime, I'll say you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502 if you have a question for Cliff as she gets that sound ready. Yeah, it's not coming through, Shelley, very well. So, but I tell you what, go ahead and send that to us, and I'll give you my email address as soon as you get something to write that down, and we will definitely use that on next month's program.
Yeah, if I can hear it. We couldn't hear it over the phone.
Right.
So
do you have something to write with?
Yeah.
Okay. My email address is W, then Beckett, B-E-C-K-E-T-T, W Beckett at L-S-U-S for Louisiana State University, Shreveport.edu.
Okay.
Great. And you can email that to me, and we will use that for next month's program.
Yeah, and let's answer Shelley's first question about it was where to go. I mean, you've already discovered, Caddo Lake is fantastic place to go, and another one, Dangerfield State Park. So our state parks are really good. You also have a National Wildlife Refuge near you called Caddo National Wildlife Refuge.
And one over here.
It's near Karnak. And there's one over here just south of Bossier called Red River National Wildlife Refuge. So those will keep you pretty busy. And you won't have to spend a lot of time in the car because they're close. And that's what you kind of want to do is find a hot spot that's close to you so you can spend more time in the field instead of behind the wheel. So I think you're good with those. There's a community that I really love up in Franklin County. Mount Vernon is the county seat. They have, last I looked, they had about nine birding trail sites, or what we call wildlife trail sites, just in that Mount Vernon area. So you might investigate also the on the Parks and Wildlife website, the wildlife trails. And these are driving trails, and they're basically all the hot spots to find birds and other critters. So it would tell you if you're in the hill country where to go see bats emerging. If you're in the panhandle, it would tell you where to go see a prairie dog town and so forth. So it's not just birds, but I'm a little biased. I like that it focuses greatly on birds. So
well, I'm getting into them. They're cool. Really fascinating, and I enjoy your show. So
great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, Shelley, and I look forward to your email, and I'm hoping I can hear the recording. And so maybe in the meantime, try again, make some more recordings using your video feature on your cell phone. There's some apps, too, that you can record. And so just, yeah, try to
find
something.
I find it's best if you can kind of get it close to where the bird is and then walk away, literally leave it for 5-10 minutes, and we can edit it down, you know. It's easier to do that. Once you're close, the bird's going to probably quiet up. But if you just leave the phone on the ground and walk away for a while, then it may really chime.
Yeah, try that, yeah. Shelley.
Well, I have the recording here. It probably has more to do with the phone that I'm on. It's a very old phone with a cord on it.
Wow, what's that? I've never seen.
This is my grandparents.
I remember one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. I
yeah.
Know.
It's, cool.
It's probably a technological.
I think that was before World War II. So, no. I grew up with one of those back when you didn't have a portable phone. Your portable phone was you moved yourself over to the phone.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, very cool. Smithland, I'm going to look for that next time I'm up in Marion County. So thanks for the call, Shelley.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And any question about birds or birding or our avian world is welcome. And we go next to Israel from Longview, Texas. Israel, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Okay, so I have been walking out of my house, and I have seen this mockingbird on these power lines. And I have been seeing it, like, almost every month.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to know what a mockingbird's lifespan is.
Oh, that's a good question. I thought you were going to ask if he's recharging his cell phone sitting up there on the power line.
Doing the electric mockingbird.
Yeah, that would be a good thing to do. But so mockingbirds, there is a website. It's the Bird Banding Lab at the USGS in Patuxent, Maryland. They have longevity records, so those are the oldest of the old using banded birds. And I don't have all those memorized. There's hundreds of species with lots of ages, but I'm going to bet that a mockingbird can easily make it to 10 years. And if that doesn't sound like a lot, that's a lot for a bird that size. So at least 10 years. There are hummingbird records that, like, I think it's a broad-tailed or a black-chinned or both that made it to 12 or 13 years. So, but you know, larger birds, of course, live longer, like our whooping cranes and bald eagles. They're very long-lived birds. They could live 30, 40, 50 years. The oldest bird known is an albatross, and what's amazing, I'm trying to remember her name. They named it. But what's amazing is she was still laying eggs at age 62. So, she's got a famous name, and I can't remember it. You can Google it, and it's one of the albatross, maybe wandering albatross. And she's got a name. She was banded 60-something years ago by Chandler Robbins. And actually, before he passed away, he got to revisit with this albatross, and she looked great. I mean, she looked like you couldn't tell if she was 5 years old or 62 years old. And of course, the funny thing is, Chandler, like any human over 50 years, has aged significantly. So the bird looked a lot better, is what I'm saying. So, but Israel, back to your question, the mockingbird would easily make it to 10 years. And if you go on that website, just Google USGS for US Geological Survey. BBL, Bird Banding Lab, bird longevity records, and you can spend an hour looking through that, and it's pretty neat. You know, Carolina Wren, I think 7 years, American Goldfinch, about the same, but mockingbirds probably going to be 10 to 14 years, somewhere in that ballpark. Does that sound about right to you, Israel?
Yeah, I've been seeing him for a long time, and he just sits there on the power line.
Yep.
Just there.
And is that mockingbird older than you? If he's 10?
I don't know.
If he's 10, is he older than you?
I'm 11.
Okay. I thought I scented a little bit of youth in you, so that's good. Are you a budding bird watcher? Or is this new for you, or have you always been a bird watcher?
No, I haven't watched many birds, but I have made a video on my YouTube channel about these Carolina chickadees in my lamppost in my backyard.
Oh, wow.
We'd love to see that.
Yeah, tell the audience how to find your YouTube video. Do you have a title for it? What would we search for on YouTube?
You would search for Carolina chickadees.
Uh-huh. That would
Israel Purdom.
What did you say? What was that last word?
Israel Purdom.
Okay. So Carolina chickadee Israel Purdom. How do you spell that last word? P-E-R-D-I-N?
P-U-R-D-U-N.
P-U-R-D-U-N. Okay. That's cool, because when I get back to computer, Israel, I'm going to look that up and check it out. So that sounds pretty neat. So keep up the good work, Israel, and why don't you try getting a video of your mockingbird next?
Okay.
And cool. Israel, is it okay if we create an embed link to that YouTube video on our page?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, cool.
Cool, man. All right, thanks so much.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And any call regarding our avian world are welcome. And I think that albatross was called the Betty White albatross.
No, I've just taken a guess.
No. Betty stays with us forever.
Well, I've got my cell phone here. I can Google it, too.
All right. And we're going to go to Lorraine next from Wynn Parish. Lorraine, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Well, actually, you were. I was remembering the guy who had the problem with buzzards and his poultry, and I would like to tell you about our problem with buzzards and baby lambs.
Okay.
We were living on a farm in Georgia 60 years ago, and we had one of those fronts come through where the lows were in the low, and that lows were even high. You know, it was cold, and everything was frozen. And we were standing there watching the little lambs, and this buzzard was circling. And before we could do anything, he swooped down, picked the lamb up, and flew away. Our county agent said that was not unusual. It didn't happen often, but it was not unusual enough to comment on. So if the guy is still concerned about his poultry, I don't think we're going to have that kind of weather anytime soon.
Yeah.
But he might want to keep an eye on his poultry.
Okay.
If the buzzard is still there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Well, that's a great tip. Thank you for the call about that, and I appreciate that information.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Did you remember the name of that?
Well, I didn't remember it. I had to Google
it. Looked it up.
And the famous albatross's name is Wisdom.
Okay, wisdom of the ages.
Yes.
There you go. Well, if you live long enough, you might get a little wisdom if you're lucky.
Yes, that's not a typical name to remember, you know.
No.
I would have named her Betty or Ann or Susie, but they named her Wisdom. But that's a great name. And let me tell you, 62 years old, and that's not dog years. Let me make that clear. There's no such thing as bird years. This is the same 62 years that any of us listening are going to live. So imagine still laying eggs and feeding young and living out on the sea. So it probably means there's something to that lifestyle. I think that lifestyle being always active and moving and a buffet of seafood, fishes. Mm-hmm. There's probably something to eating healthy. So I don't know. If we want to live that long, I don't know if anybody listening, any of the ladies want to have babies at 62, but albatrosses still do. I think that's pretty remarkable.
Well, as long as they're having fun.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, and we have Sam next from Central Vernon Parish. Sam, you're on with Cliff. What's your question? Go ahead, Sam. Oh, well, might help if I have the right fader up. There you go, Sam.
Are we there?
Yeah, that's a theory.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry. I spoke too quick. First of all, I'm curious to know what the call of a Mississippi kite is, because I've only seen one in my life locally around where I live. I'm 15 miles east of Leesville, Louisiana, between Leesville and Alexandria, Louisiana.
Yeah.
So I'm central Louisiana. Okay, so I was curious to know. I've seen one, and I'd love to see another one because it's great. And then back to the lady that was calling about the light-colored mockingbird. I want to, first of all, invite anyone that wants to take a trip out here. I live on a family place here, and I have some huge, big old oak trees everywhere, and I have a massive amount of birds of every kind, stuff that I've never seen before.
Right.
And, yes, I have at least two or three mockingbird nests in a big live oak tree that I'm sitting under right now.
Cool.
Now, here's my question, and it's a serious question for bird lovers of all kinds. Crows are notorious for robbing these little birds' nests, okay? And I happen to know that a mockingbird will swoop down and catch all kinds of bugs and feed their babies, but I've never seen crows catch a bug and go feed their babies. They'll catch little baby mockingbirds and stuff. So here, being an old Marine that I am, messing with the crows that are killing the little baby mockingbirds?
Well, how long have crows been on your property before you is the question. And how long have crows and mockingbirds been together before you and I have been on this planet?
So, many years, my friend.
Millennia.
Many years.
Millennia. So why would we want to tamper with that? I would say find something else to do. I'd say worry about the squirrels that are chewing on your house. Yeah.
Okay, let me say this real quick. I went over to the Ukraine here a couple of years ago, and I was walking around an old battle park over there, and I noticed they had pigeons but very few crows. And on my flight back, I mentioned it to an individual, and he said, that's because they eat them. Now, let me tell you this, Mr. Cliff. The crows in the Ukraine, they do crow in a different voice. It's a Ukrainian crow voice. And they have a little slight silver streak down their back. And I only saw two up close the whole time I was there in 2 weeks.
Yeah, there's another species over there called the jackdaw. It's a corvid. It's a relative of the crows, and it does sound different. It looks a little different.
Yeah, it has a Ukrainian crow.
Yeah,
a cow.
Yeah,
a call.
Yeah, maybe that's the Eurasian jackdaw. I've never been to the Ukraine, but I'm guessing that's what it is, and it does sound different.
Again, my major question was the sound of a
Mississippi kite. Yeah,
yes,
it's a whistle. It's a almost a two-part whistle, like a and I don't think we have that one, Bill.
I don't believe it's
in the future, Sam, for us to profile the Mississippi kite, but we haven't done it yet, so we don't have it in our music files, but it's a high-pitched whistle.
I was honored to have watched one of them put on an air show. I was running a backhoe, cleaning some land up, and I had a bonfire going. And this was fascinating that the Mississippi kite, I wasn't paying attention. I was running a hoe.
Yeah.
Well, I kept on seeing a shadow. Well, I thought it was crows. And when I finally took a break and got off, I saw this thing, and it was putting on an air show. And I guess it was straight above the bonfire.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Well, so when you see them do a lot of aerial acrobatics, is because they are an insectivorous bird and they're chasing things. So they're after dragonflies and grasshoppers and other large insects that are up there that you and I can't see, but they can, and they'll dive for them. So that they're fun to watch. When you see one stoop and make a quick turn or shoot down like a fighter jet, he's after food. Yeah.
I just want to, before we close off here, I know other people are waiting. I wanted to invite anyone that's nice people. Like I say, I'm about 15 miles east of Leesville. I live in a beautiful old place here. And I have more birds around here than I've never seen before in my life. So it's a bird watcher's paradise.
And you've got bonfires, and I bet you'd cook some etouffee.
I haven't had a bonfire. I can make a mean H2FA. I really do.
So what I'm getting at is, it sounds like you're going to have a big party, Sam. Is what I'm getting at. You're going to have bird watching, and then followed with the etouffee and a bonfire, and that sounds like a lot of fun.
I'll bring the tater salad.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the call, Sam. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We've got Clyde from Nacogdoches online. Clyde, what's your question for Cliff?
Well, actually, it's an observation. Your discussion of the aged albatross wisdom made me think of I was recently reading a bit of World War One history, and the Battle of the Falkland Islands in December of 1914. And one of the things that happened there is the pair of British battlecruisers sank Admiral von Spee's squadron, including the armored cruisers Scharnhorst and Nisenout, put the crews into the water. And according to the accounts, the guys in the water were attacked by swarms of albatrosses that thought they were dinner.
Huh. Well, I've never heard of that.
I hadn't either.
Yeah.
I was reading that.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of chumming for albatrosses. Birdwatchers hire to go on boats to go see albatrosses and storm petrels and shearwaters and other birds, and they'll chum for it. But I've never heard of anybody getting swooped on by an albatross. So, yeah.
I've wondered if they misidentified possibly frigate birds, which are extremely predatory.
Yeah, and they too wouldn't really dive bomb. I think probably the verb they used was incorrect.
The people, they were observed, kind of sliding along, and dipping down and biting people.
Yeah. Now, the only time I would, if they were at a nesting site, that wouldn't be in the water, that'd be on land, I could see.
They were out of sight of out in the middle of the South Atlantic.
Yeah.
Where they didn't last long.
Right. So I don't know what they saw. That's an interesting account. And certainly seabirds will dive bomb people that are near their eggs. And that's a good time to mention that there's a lot of people going down the coast and fishing and beach combing, and that's great. But remember that a lot of our coastal birds that are colonial nesters are in the middle of raising young. And so if you see birds that are dive bombing you, that's because you're probably about to step on their eggs that can blend in with the sand and be very camouflaged. So the best thing is to tiptoe backwards out of there and let birds do their job of raising young. They're trying to have a family just like we are. And so a little respect, give birds a little bit of room, and don't squish their eggs, and certainly don't pick up their eggs. So just want to do a little shout out about being protective to our colonial nesting birds on our beaches and spoil islands, et cetera, on the Gulf here.
Anyway, I thought you might find that interesting, and I love your show.
Great. Right. Thanks, Clyde.
Thanks, Clyde. We appreciate it. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. That's 800-552-8502. And while we have a short break here between the calls, Chuck Ome from El Largo, Texas. Chuck, I hope I got your last name correct, and if not, I apologize. So, but you had sent in an image, and you asked Cliff to take a look at this picture, and you can't figure out what it was. It almost looks like something from a pet store or a feeder, and you had asked Cliff to go ahead and identify that, and it is on our website, by the way, folks, so you can go along and follow along. It's right below our profile species today.
And this bird that Chuck sent is out of sight cool. I encourage people to go look at this picture. You'll never see another one like this. This is very interesting looking bird, and it's at a soot feeder. He's south of Houston, and I think it's a painted bunting that has a genetic disorder called xanthism. That's spelled with an X, Xanthism.
Now, what's so bright?
It's the yellowing of feathers and the complete absence of any of the reds, the red pigment and feathers. And so this bird is just glowing yellow and bright green above, and it's certainly a painted bunting chassis. But I would not think it's a cage bird. I think it's just this abnormality, which is super cool. And thanks for Chuck for taking a picture, because I've never seen one that looks like this. I've seen the only odd painted bunting I personally have seen was near Elephant Mountain in Brewster County, Texas, out west north of Big Bend, and it was a painted bunting which has red all the way underneath up to the bill, so that even the throat is red, except this individual I saw, and it's only been about 3 years, had a yellow throat. So it was really striking looking, and that I thought that was neat. It was just the throat was yellow, but this bird Chuck found is just off the charts gorgeous. So go tell everybody again how to find that picture, Bill.
That is on our website, redriverradio.org. And this month, the post for bird calls is sort of at the bottom of the homepage, near the bottom. So you'll just have to scroll down past all of the news with COVID and everything else going on recently. We rejuggled our news feed and put all the news stuff up front. And just open up the post, you'll see that. And you'll also see the bird coming up. Now, this is rare. Marty Shaunter, who I know from Gainesville, Florida, posted images of sandhill cranes in her neighborhood. Now, there's a lot of sandhill cranes just south of Gainesville, Florida, at the Paynes Prairie Reserve, because we used to go out there a lot and watch them, and that's a breeding area, so it's a big wetlands area full of gators and even buffalo, Southeast American buffalo or bison. And this one is right in her yard.
Yeah, you sent me those, and I thought, what a cool yard bird that would be. And a lot of people, you know, they use the colloquial name for the great blue heron. They think that they've seen a great blue heron along the road or in their yard, and they said it's a crane. But this one certainly is a sandhill crane with the little red cap on top. It stands a little taller than a great blue heron, and it's pretty neat that they have them in their yard. I'd love to have that one walking around my yard looking for lizards and grasshoppers and things.
Well, being part of radio, we used to go out and record a lot. Donna Green Townsend, somebody I worked with, records a lot of sounds out there because she actually lives out on the edge of that at that area on Orange Lake in Cross Creek, a name from a movie. That's a famous little town that was Marjorie Kennan Rawlings cool. wrote about that. And The Yearling is set there too, the old movie The Yearling. So.
Yeah.
And now also I'd seen this video on Facebook, and it is a strange video of a group of brown thrashers attacking a hog snake. They're teaming up to attack it.
A hog nose,
trying to get to their nest. And so is that a common thing among these snakes?
It's a common behavior for birds to try to, if what's probably happening, you don't see a nest, but there's likely a nest within 10 feet or so of that snake, and the parents are trying to be good parents, and they're trying to lure the snake, because most snakes are egg eaters. Now the hognose isn't going to really, he's not a big climber, he's not going to probably be the one, but to a bird, a snake is a snake, and so their display is really neat, to puff up, flash open their wings, flare their tail, and look big.
And they even peck at it.
And they peck at it. That's right. They, get from behind it and just aggravate it. So the snake eventually is like, this isn't worth it. I'm out of here. And the job is done by the successful parents, the protective parents. So we would do this too if we saw danger near our kids. So kudos to the brown thrasher for doing that. Yeah.
All right. And although the call was cutting in and out, Wally did get the question from one of the callers, and they said they had just moved to an area near Jasper. He lived near Sam Rayburn Dam, and he wants to know if he should be seeing osprey. He has not seen one and wants to know why. Where are they?
Yeah. Osprey is a very, very rare local nester in East Texas. I would think there's not as many as 10 nesting pairs each year. they're that unusual. So, but there's hardly a month that goes by that we don't have ospreys in our area. So, this right now is the period when you would not see an osprey if they're not nesting in our area. So, I would say he needs to just wait a few more weeks because northern breeders are going to start showing up in the summer. And some of those osprey might travel as far as South America, which is pretty amazing. So, yeah, so you can see osprey at least 10 months of the year, even when they're not nesting. But if you have a nest nearby, there's a nest I know of near 6 Mile on Toledo Bend. That's maybe 30 minutes from him. If he looks up 6 Mile, there's the cove there. If you look off on the bridge that crosses 6 Mile, it's going north-south. If you look to the west, there's a giant topped cypress tree. Topped meaning it's got no limbs, and right on top of it is an osprey nest, and they've been nesting there for 8 or 10 of the last year, several years, eight or 10 years in a row now. Yeah, I don't know if he's got any nests on that side of Sam Rayburn.
And they also they always up high, right? They're
the nest
treetop
nesters. Yeah, it's going to look
or light pole nesters, which I've seen them on top of huge light poles over football stadiums and such.
Yeah, they typically in Texas don't like to put the nest in a tree like a bald eagle does. A bald eagle builds a much larger nest. It's a larger bird, and they look typically for a whorl in near the top of a pine tree. A whorl is where more than two limbs come out at one point and create kind of a structure that would hold a giant stick nest. So it'd be kind of like a cup holder if you kind of envision that. And so, of course, the nest they build is the size of your refrigerator in your kitchen, laying on its side. That's probably about the size of bald eagle nest. So osprey's nest is smaller, but they put them on power poles that go over lakes. And top trees, like I mentioned. There's another nest on Lake Nacogneach near Appleby, Texas, and several more, but I'm not going to list them all. So,
all right, and we do have one more caller online, Dustin from Lufkin. You are on with Cliff. What's your question?
A couple of weeks or a month ago or something, I saw like a miniature corvid that was like black and white, had really big eyes. It looks like a miniature cardinal or something. Anyway,
a corvid is a crow or jay.
Okay, all right.
Okay.
Well, it had like I said, it looked like the cardinal where it had like the point on the top of it.
Oh, a crest.
Crest. Yeah.
Okay. So, he was black and white.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. And he had like. He's a real small body, but like really big eyes, or maybe it was like the coloration around the eyes. I've not seen one of those come through, before.
Okay,
so,
well,
I'm just curious.
I'm racking my brain here because just a crested bird narrows the field considerably. Everybody knows the blue jay and the titmouse and the cardinal, but the pileated woodpecker. It is a black and white bird with some red on it, but it's got a crest. Maybe it's got some big eyes. I don't know, but I don't know what you saw. If it wasn't a pileated woodpecker, I'm blanking, my brain here. So I'd say, Dustin, if you see it again, try to snap a photo and let's study your picture if you can.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, and I think it's time that we go to our conservation tip. You said you had a little bit longer one, and then if we have time at the end of that, I've got a couple of more questions.
Okay, and before I start that, I thought this would be also a good time to talk about Dustin takes a picture of the bird, and we talked about before the show, someone sent in a video from our last call about
the
Jaguarundi. And so that video that she sent, and we appreciate her sending that, was the bird, the mammal was too far off, too fuzzy. And the thing to remember, Carl Sagan said it best, is, there's an acronym called ECRI, and that acronym stands for Extraordinary Claims Require Extraordinary Evidence. So if you have something as rare as a Jaguarundi, you're going to want to have really full frame photos, I'm sorry to say. Distant, you know, with a cell phone and the critter's way off, I couldn't rule out cat at all. So same with Dustin. If you've got something that you think is super unusual, you've got to prove it. You've got to show evidence. And it's not that people think that the observer is lying. The problem is it's an error. We're all humans. I make mistakes. You know, in that episode last month, we started off, remember, with me correcting something I said the previous month about chitin and keratin. So I'm happy to mention when I've made a mistake. But back to the Jaguarundi, Ekri, Carl Sagan, famous astronomer, astrophysicist. He was an incredible science communicator. Ekri, that's what you got to remember when you're in this business, is extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence to rule out human error. Okay, so let's move on to our conservation tip. We end every episode with a little tip, something for people to think about doing. It's not required activities, but it might make you think of this helping birds in some way. So add a means of escape to any backyard water source is the title. So many of us desiring to attract wildlife provide the three main supplements required: food, water, and native cover. A bird bath is a popular way to provide water, as are backyard ponds or small rural ponds on the farm. In dry western states, some landowners put out rainwater catchment devices that sit low in the ground called water guzzlers. Taller water tanks, though, mainly serve livestock and deer. Birds obviously need water for drinking and bathing, so they are attracted to all of these man-made water sources. Sometimes birds, frogs, lizards, and small mammals accidentally fall in, which is fine if they can swim to the edge and crawl out, but what if the edge is slippery or too high where they can't reach it? These scenarios end up being deadly traps when birds, tired of struggling, quickly drown. If you have such a water source, help the birds and other wildlife by adding a makeshift escape ladder. This is as simple as placing a sturdy tree limb in the water to give animals a way to crawl out to dry land. Replace that limb when it degrades or rots. Some backyard swimming pools are notorious for drowning animals, and I'm certainly not advocating for placing a limb in your pool, but consider creating some other type of escape ladder for wildlife. Keeping critters from drowning also will keep you from having to remove a nasty, decaying carcass that can foul up your water. Providing drinking water for birds is a great idea, but ensure that it's safe. Do it for the birds.
All right, and you have been listening to Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and this has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our program is produced here at the studios of Red River Radio and our Knoll Foundation studios. We'd like to thank the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for lending us Cliff for these programs. He is their statewide ornithologist. Our producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with technical assistance from Troy Jones, and the phone bank assistance tonight, Wally Derleth. The two sound files used in tonight's program for our species were from xenocanto.org and were recorded by Mike Nelson and Paul Marvin, respectively. This month's bird photo on our Bird Calls page was snapped by James Childress. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in just a few hours, and that is redriverradio.org. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip that you would like to send to Cliff, you can send them to wbeckett@lsus.edu. Be sure to join us next week for What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, and the next installment of Bird Calls is next month on Tuesday, July 14th, and this is Red River Radio.